Well, you know, we're here.
Recorder is on.
Okay, all right. Well, since the recorder's on, should we start with the, we have a little bit of formality to say that, you know, we're recording this for the purposes of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were created by the 2009 stimulus bill to study the causes of the financial crisis and to produce a report to the President and the Congress this December. And so we're recording it just because, if we go back, we want to make any quotes for the book. It'd be nice to have any, make sure we didn't misquote you. But if we do that, in any case, we check with you as well. So we wouldn't ever use your comments for attribution without your pre-approval.
Sure.
But the record's nice to have. And also, at some point, the commission may decide to put these into an archive that would be available to the public at some future date.
Okay.
That's not, since it depends on a vote of the bipartisan commission, we can't say for sure that that will or will not happen, but it might. So.
Okay.
Then, having said that, what we usually do is mention that today is the 30th, and we're about 12:15, and we're the people that are here on the table are myself, Randall Dodd, Steve Mintz, Stuart Schroff. If you two could say your name and spell your last name for the record, that would help.
I'm Karen Pence, and P-E-N-C-E is Pence.
David Caperton, C-A-P-E-R-T-O-N.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being so far. Oh, I think we should, if you consent to have the conversation recorded, aren't we supposed to say that formally, David?
Yeah,
I don't know. Yes, we are.
I think we
yes,
are.
We
are. Supposed to ask if you consent to have the conversation recorded.
I consent.
Okay, thank you very much. That was quick and easy. I like that. Well, what we want to, we're trying to study the impact of the causes of the financial crisis, and one of the aspects of it is how it spread through the financial system and hit the real economy. And one of the ways is how it affected municipal financing, student loan financing, and even some nonprofit institutions like hospitals and art museums and so forth.
Exactly.
And that vehicle for that were a lot of the variable rate securities issued as often as part of a synthetic fixed funding arrangement. And so we were told that you were knowledgeable about that funding market for the student loan market. And so we wanted to ask you a few questions because, in my view, one of the challenges of the commission is to be able to describe the way the markets worked very thoroughly and clearly, and then to describe, you know, how that was disrupted. They ceased to function as efficiently during the crisis, and try to explain that role. And our hypothesis that we're working on here is, and you can confirm or deny or improve on it, is that this is one of the really more interesting stories of the crisis, really, because we don't think of student loans as being having to do with subprime mortgages, and so why did it get flummoxed? And our hypothesis is that it occurred through two channels. One, because the monolines who had been wrapping some of the securities as a credit enhancement, they became impaired because their investments and their CDS protection sold on subprime assets. And then secondly, because a lot of these instruments depended upon the participation of the broker-dealers to maintain the auctions, or in the case of variable rate demand obligations of banks as letters of credit. And so there's sort of two channels. First, through the monoline wrap or credit enhancement, and secondly, through the key major financial firms that were acting to really facilitate the liquidity in these kind of short duration financial instruments. So to let you know, that's our hypothesis. You know, anything you can add or correct, that's what we're looking for here.
Okay.
So first, I was wondering, we're having a hard time finding good data on the size of the securitized student loan market, and I was wondering if the Fed had gone out and tried to collect that information.
I can tell you the data sources we use internally. We get issuance data for the entire student loan ABS market from one of the investment banks. So the investment banks regularly put that out in their report to their clients.
Uh-huh.
We also tabulate it from Bloomberg. We subscribe to a product called Bloomberg Back Office, which is a deal-level data set from Bloomberg. It's another product called Asset-Backed Alert, which is a trade publication, but they maintain data, and they've sent data. A challenge is that usually they pool together two types of securitizations. So as I'm sure you know, there were the government-guaranteed student loans that were originated under the, I can't remember if it's Federal Family or Federal Education Loan Program, FFELP. Mm-hmm. That was eliminated July 1st of this year. But until then, that was kind of the major engine of student loan securitization, as the private institutions that originated those loans generally funded them with securitization. But there were also the so-called private student loans.
So private.
Yeah, you know, students take out if they've exhausted their government guaranteed loan availability. And so a lot of these, the student loan ABS numbers you see aggregate those two. One of the places I go to look at the private thing is DBRS, the Dominion Bond Rating Service. They calculate a delinquency rate on private student loans, and they have a useful piece they write up every quarter, which is publicly available on their website. It's called, I don't know, Private Student Loan Delinquencies. And they get those delinquencies, I believe, from the pool level reports from the securities. So there's a table at the end where they list all of the securities they're using and what the outstanding balances are in those securities.
Okay.
So I tend to, they may be missing a few, but I tend to use that as kind of my rough gauge as the size of the private student loan ABS market, and then subtract that off of a total you might get from an investment bank.
I see. I assume when they structure them, they do separate them at that point.
Oh, yeah. They're
strictly separated. The data's not...
Right.
Segregated.
Right. There's a few of the state nonprofits that are active in this market, I think, commingle some government guaranteed and private student loans, but that's pretty rare. For the most part, you can operate under the assumption that they're completely different securitization markets.
And those are state nonprofit issuers?
It's a little. Let me step back a little. There are these very, I've never come up with a great word how to describe these entities. I can tell you how they came to be, which is that, the Federal Family Education Loan Program started in 1965. And one of the problems originally was very akin to the mortgage market, was kind of a lack of liquidity. You know, because the same thing as a mortgage is a fairly long-term loan. And banks would not necessarily want to hold them forever, and there wouldn't be a lot of secondary market liquidity. And so that's why Congress started Sallie Mae in 1972, you know, kind of equivalent to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I think states, here I'm not an expert, this is my general understanding, so I don't want to represent myself as an expert, but states started something similar to help
this is not
states.
A test, so
okay.
If you say anything wrong,
okay.
You're helping us out.
So, for example, there's an organization called Brazos, B-R-A-Z-O-S, that at one point was like the fourth or sixth largest holder of government-guaranteed student loans in the U.S.
Is that in Texas, by chance?
Yeah, it's in Texas.
It's pronounced Brazos.
Oh, Brazos, okay,
so
thank you.
You don't get beat up when you go down to Dallas or something.
Thanks, see, good. Well, I'm glad I already stipulated I wasn't an expert before you made that correction. So the state of Texas, you know, every state has a tax-exempt bond allotment. Like, there's a certain amount of tax-exempt bonds that they're allowed to issue under, and again, it's outside my expertise, but whatever it is that governs that. And so part of their tax-exempt bond allotment can be for student loans. And so typically these kind of quasi-public-private corporations, I've never quite understood the structure, like Brazos would be set up, and the state of Texas would give them some of their state-exempt bond allotment. And they could use that to kind of leverage other funding sources and so act as a secondary market. So Brazos is a big one.
So it's probably a state-owned corporation that's incorporated in Texas?
I've never quite understood. There's a kind because Pennsylvania has one also that's very large. It's called the Pennsylvania Higher Education. I forget what the A's stand for, something. It's Assistance Association or something, FIA. And there, I think it's true, the governor appoints someone to sit on their board. Mm-hmm. And usually there's some sort of understanding that these corporations will return some of their profits. Usually they have, like, scholarships for state students, or they run financial aid centers to help students get counseling, something like that. So usually there's some sort of deal like that. I've never quite understood how the structure works, besides the fact that there's some state role, but they're not a state agency. But there's an association with the state, and I think the linkages vary across states. But most states have one of these. You know, Montana has one, Mississippi has one, Tennessee has one, mm-hmm. And they're a large part of the market.
And they're for either citizens or people going to school in that state?
Yeah, usually.
So the local banks don't want to hold it, so that creates a secondary market for presumably Texas Bank or Texas students.
Exactly. Uh-huh. That was originally, anyway. I mean, I'm not sure how much. Today, I think it's probably a much more liquid national market, but that's the history of where those institutions came from. And that's also the history of why the auction rate securities became embedded in this market, because since these were kind of quasi-state agencies, it was very natural for them to use a municipal bond model in setting up the auction rate securities. And they shared the common problem that municipalities have, which is they don't have cash lying around, right? So getting a letter of credit is very expensive, because you don't have, like, if you're a financial institution, say you have, like, you know, all these assets, all these capital, all these accounts you can use as collateral. And usually all a state has is its power to tax. You know, they don't want to keep a lot of money lying around just in a savings account or something like that. So that's why the auction-rated securities model was natural. And so if you look at securitizers, most of the auction-rate securitizers were these state nonprofits. So Sallie Mae did not do very much auction rate at all, for example. And then there were some finance companies that kind of late in the 2000s adopted the model also. But that's kind of the historic roots why it became part of this.
Could you describe a little bit these private corporations that also were doing some of the securitization? These are finance companies, non-bank, non-broker-dealer.
Yeah, so, well, for example, Sallie Mae is a finance company now, so they're the biggest one. They did not do auction rate securities because they're well capitalized, right? So auction rate securities are a very attractive funding source if you don't have much capital, you know, as opposed to, as you were mentioning earlier, kind of like a letter of credit or something that requires an explicit liquidity support. You know, in auction rate securities, it's an implicit liquidity support. You don't have to actually put up any capital. It's just based on the notion that it's always worked and it's going to keep on working. So it's attractive if you don't have capital. So if you started up a finance company and you wanted to get into this market but you didn't have much capital, it was an attractive funding source. And most of those, I think, are now out of business.
Now, the relationship with the credit enhancement, were anyone besides Monolines providing that?
That I don't know. I'm not aware of anyone other than Monolines, but I don't know.
And was the credit enhancement as a like a bond guarantee you would do for a muni bond, or was it something different?
Were you talking about the auction rate or the mono? Because the Monolines didn't just insure auction rate securities,
right?
I mean, the Monolines also, you know, the private student loan space. They guaranteed, I think it was First Marblehead. You know, I can talk about First Marblehead, but it's in the private student loan space, so I don't want to go off on that tangent if you want me to stay on auction rate in the short run.
Why don't we just go back to a describing, I think it might be an appropriate time to kind of segue into that briefly. What kind of credit enhancements were used, both on the more normal structured student loan products as well as the more variable rate products?
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not an expert. I'll give you kind of what I think is true, but I don't want to represent myself to be an expert. So there's basically, and I know the private student loan structure is a little better than the government guaranteed structures. But for example, the private student loan structures, if you look at the ones, for example, that Sallie Mae did, so they were the biggest securitizer of private student loans, and they would do a traditional senior substructure, you know, where you have a AAA-rated tranche and supported by lower-rated tranches.
So you had one senior and then multiple subordinate structures?
I believe so. I believe there's a AAA tranche and then, yeah, junior tranches. Now, that was their pre-crisis structure. They've had to move to a very different structure, you know, during and post-crisis. The reason for that being that it's very hard to place long maturity asset-backed securities in the market. There's still not a lot of investor appetite for things that are more than 5 years. There's not a lot of appetite in the traditional buyers for what they called long-dated floaters, were things like, you know, the structured investment vehicles, it was the European banks, it's a class of investors that are not in the market anymore. So now Sallie Mae uses a much different structure where they'll issue a 5-year bond and then just way over collateralize it. Like, say, put in $5 million of student loans to support $5 billion in loans, say, to support $3 billion in notes. And then because you have so many more student loans than you do bonds, you can structure just a 5-year bond, and then Sallie Mae gets the rest back at the end.
Right, so it's just a single tranche over collateralized, AAA. Uh-huh.
So that's what the structures tend to be
now.
I see,
and that's probably just a traditional kind of bullet bond.
No, I think the investors get payment. There's a bullet to Sallie Mae at the end.
The principal's bullet, not the coupon. They pay coupons, but not the principal at the end.
No, I don't think so. I think it's structured. There's enough cash coming in that you can pay off principal and interest, even though the loans, you know, student loans after you can be 30 years. Well, private student loans don't go beyond 20, but they're a 20-year asset, right? So even though they don't pay off all the cash in 5 years. If there are enough student loans in the tranche, you know, they're bringing in enough cash that you can pay off the principal and interest in 5 years, and then Sallie Mae would get the rest at the end. So they just used a very typical. I think their structure was very traditional, you know, the senior sub. I don't think they used monoline insurers at all, but they would have used kind of these typical, like, over collateralization. Those kind of things. First Marblehead had the other business model in the private student loan space, and so they used monoline insurers. And the way First Marblehead worked was as an aggregator for commercial banks. So they would buy things, they would buy, I can't remember, but somebody like, say, Bank of America, the big banks, would sell their private student loans to First Marblehead, who would aggregate them. And they got a guarantee from this company known as Terry, T-E-R-I.
That was a credit guarantee?
I think it was a specialized credit guarantee for private student loans. And Terry went bankrupt. And that was a big, First Marblehead has not been able to securitize since. So that caused a lot of their bonds to be downgraded. And there's been kind of this lengthy bankruptcy process.
So they were also single tranche products, but that were not over collateralized, but instead used a private bond insurer.
I don't know the structure of those. I'm guessing these are all pre-crisis. I'm guessing they were senior sub. I just know that they did use the monolines, this particular monoline, and it was to get to your question about the monoline. The failure of that monoline caused them. They have not securitized since maybe 2007, maybe 2008. They might. Some of these things had an auction rate tranche, so you don't have to have a whole auction rate security. Mm-hmm. And so they might have. And I think Sallie Mae had a couple securities too, where there was an auction rate tranche. And I think, again, that was because of the maturity mismatch that it had something to do with the fact that the student loans being very long-dated, and this was a way to manage the cash flow better. I don't remember the details.
Now, who was issuing then the do you know, can you give us some examples of securitizers, of loan originators or securitizers that were using ARS or other variable instruments to fund?
Right, so those were all these. So that is, so as I said, in the private student loan, it was mostly like if they used the AR auction rate, it was like an auction rate tranche. And maybe, I don't think there are any finance companies. Private student loans are just a couple really big securitizers. So Sallie Mae, First Marblehead, Student Loan Corporation, which is that part of Citibank that they just sold. You know, they sold their private student loans to Discover and their government guarantee to Sallie Mae. And Access Group, which again is one of these quasi-public-private things that specializes in buying loans from law students and medical students. They may just be a nonprofit. They may not be a state. So those are really the only four securitizers of private. Oh, and KeyBank did a little. So that's a very small, it's a very concentrated market in terms of securitization.
So Marblehead is actually, the proper name is First Marblehead?
First Marblehead Corporation.
Is it chartered as a bank or anything, or is it just a finance company from a...
I don't know. I think they bill themselves as kind of a service provider. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like an outsourcer for banks that, you know, will help you build a platform and then we'll securitize your loans. I think they probably don't have as much independent capital.
I see. So they're not otherwise prudentially regulated by any of the federal financial regulators?
I don't know.
Was Sally ever under anyone's, any other federal financial regulator?
Well, you know, Sallie Mae was a GSE through, let's see, it was a lengthy period from, I don't have the dates quite right, but from like, say, 1997 to 2003, 2004, Sallie Mae went under a gradual privatization. It was finished in 2004. They were under the oversight of Treasury. Treasury handled the privatization process. So there was an office in Treasury that handled that. Since then, they've just been regulated like any other finance company, which means, I guess, the FTC, the SEC.
Well, I suppose the SEC, only in the sense that they're issuing public securities,
mm-hmm.
they're regulating the securities, but not the
yeah.
firm,
mm-hmm.
right? So, I mean, I think that's how that would work.
Yeah.
Because they're not a broker, they're not a broker-dealer, so they're not, the firm is not regulated, it's just that their issuance of securities is regulated, because they're issuing securities, so they go through the SEC in that regard. But that's irrespective of whether a finance company or not finance company.
They do have a small industrial loan corporation regulated by the FDIC that they started a couple years ago called Sallie Mae Bank. And they're now offering deposits through there, and I think they're doing a lot of their loan originations out of the bank, their private student loan originations.
I see. But then the FDIC doesn't get consolidated supervision, so they're just looking at the ILC.
Mm-hmm.
Do any of these other, the Student Loan Corporation or Access Group or Key Bank, sounds like it's a bank?
Key Bank is regulated. And Student Loan Corp, I believe, is regulated because it's part of Citibank.
Oh, that's right. It would come under consolidated supervision of the Federal Reserve?
Maybe. I just don't know.
Well, Citi, yes. Anything Citi has
is
under the consolidated supervision under the Bank Holding Company Act of the Fed. But
yes.
Okay.
I know, by now I still get confused, the whole OCC, OTS, FDIC, state members of the Federal Reserve System.
You probably don't like alphabets.
So that's the private student loan space, where there wasn't a lot of auction rate. The auction rate was all in the government guaranteed space, and that is where the, I'm not going to mispronounce it, Brazos, you said, is how I should say it? So it's not
Brazos.
Brazos?
It's the Texas kind of lazy tongue thing, Brazos.
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 Brazos River. It's a major river in Texas.
Okay. Well, thank you.
That's right.
Brazos. So all of the state ones, which held a lot of loans, they didn't originate a lot of loans, but they held a lot of loans because they were secondary market institutions primarily. And they were very heavily dependent on the auction rate structures. And so they've been completely out of the market since 2007. They've been able to do a couple re-securitizations. A couple of the small ones, the states have helped them out. But most of the states have not helped them out. And the states are under no obligation to, no, I don't think so. The states aren't under any legal obligation to help them out. I think a couple, maybe one of the New England states or Mid-Atlantic states might have helped. Vermont, maybe it was Vermont's helped because they wanted them. Yeah. Just because they wanted their students to still have access to loans. But I think those would tend to be ones that had very small, I mean, Vermont had a very, very small auction rate security portfolio, so it's a completely different magnitude than Brazos, which I told you was like the fourth or sixth largest holder in the U.S. I mean, they held, again, they held maybe 20 billion, maybe, as loans.
Brazos did.
Somewhere
and by
between
holding,
15 and 25.
After you securitize it, you don't hold it anymore, right? So that's $20 billion after you securitize?
That's including securitized loans, yeah. That's what I mean by held. But the Department of Education, if you're interested, they have on their website these very useful spreadsheets that list for every year who the top originators and who the top holders are.
Okay.
So that's just what I'm recalling from memory.
Oh, okay. So another data source.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I found those very useful.
Uh-huh. So most of the ARS was used in the government guaranteed part of the student loan market.
Almost exclusively. Yeah.
Okay. Did back when, just to wrap up a little bit more with the private part of the market, did they ever use any variable rate demand obligations or any other type of similar instruments other than ARS?
I think that was more I'm never going to say it, Brazos.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was more the Brazoses of the world and not
Brazi.
The Brazi of the world.
Okay, but to your best recollection, it was ARS or nothing, other variable rate instrument in the private part of it?
I think the private was almost exclusively these senior substructures.
Okay.
Which, again, might have an auction rate tranche.
Yeah, right.
Or a variable rate demand note within the structure, but I don't think overall were structured like that. But they certainly didn't, I'm pretty sure they didn't use these master trust structures. Which is the auction rate problem.
Sorry. Okay. So our focus should be then more on the government guaranteed part of the market.
If you want to think about auction rate, if you want to think about monoline bond insurance, I think then you want to talk about the private part.
Huh.
That's where there was a monoline. I think this Terry thing was a monoline, where there was one that went bankrupt. But I think they didn't need it as much in the government guaranteed space because underlying collateral are insured.
Right. That's exactly why we wanted to talk to you, because that's one of the conundrums, I think.
Uh-huh.
And our thinking was like, okay, we understood why in the muni market that mattered, because there are
uh-huh.
a few of them are rated, you know, high AA or something, but only very, very few are rated AAA, and so, you know, that was more key to get them really up to a tip-top credit rating to make them both more eligible and desirable for that type of trading in the market. But if you've got government-guaranteed collateral, then, you know, then I wanted to ask questions like, you know, is it structured? Do you have an equity tranche of a government of something with a government guaranteed pool?
Yeah. Sorry. So I'm mentally going to switch back to FEL, right?
Okay.
Just because I can't think of two things at once. it's a conditional guarantee on the student loans. It's depending on the vintage of the loan, it's anywhere from a 97 to 100% guarantee. It's a guarantee that you're going to be paid principal and interest, but it's not a guarantee of timely payment of principal and interest. I mean, you're eventually going to get paid, but you may not get paid right away. And so I haven't thought about monoline bond insurance in the FFEL market. I would guess that maybe that was there to ensure timely payment, because the government guarantee is not a timely payment. So that's different from, say, SBA securities, where they guarantee timely payment.
Right.
But
right.
That's not the guarantee in the of the FFEL loans.
So when would the payments be made on those loans?
from the payments being made. So like if a, you mean if a loan went to default, when
right.
does the investor get reimbursed? I can give you a broad overline of how it works. I don't know the whole timing, but it's very complicated. There are these, there's an additional layer between the Department of Education and the originator. There are these state things, these state guarantee agencies. There are about something like 16 or 20 of them. And so the loan first goes to the state guarantee agency, who I believe has 2 years to collect from the borrower. And then the guarantee agency takes, you know, can, if they can't succeed, they put it to the Department of Education. But they don't get, there's some diminishment, and I'm not remembering the details, but the state guarantee agency kind of takes a haircut also along the way. But I don't, I've read about it, I just can't recall exactly how it works. But something like they get reimbursed by the government a certain amount. And it depends on their overall collection activity. So it's something designed to incent them. You know, if their default rate is, say, above 10%, they get a lower reimbursement from the federal government than otherwise.
Okay. Okay, so it's a, it's not like a monoline wrap. It's not like a Fannie or Freddie type of guarantee either. But it is a, some kind of pretty good, to, pretty close to sort of a money good guarantee.
Yeah, it's just not money good on time.
Yeah, listen, not on a present value basis. And you said it may be like a, some of it is less than 100%,
uh-huh.
presumably to throw some skin in the game to avoid
yeah.
fraud and so forth.
Right, so I'm just, again, yeah. here I'm just speculating because I don't really know if there was monoline insurance in this market or not, but a if there was, a possible motive might have been timely payment.
Right, so it's pretty clearly less than 100% present value terms.
Uh-huh.
All right. So when they structured these federally guaranteed student loans,
yes.
they did use structures, senior subordinate structures.
Well, it depends who they were. So Sallie Mae, again, because they're well capitalized and they have access to external capital, they would do a senior substructure. And I think usually there would be a AAA part of 97%, you know, equivalent to the government guarantee,
uh-huh.
and then some rated B piece that was 3%. And they might have had tranching within the AAA, time tranching, I don't know.
Oh, I see. So at some point there's a little bit of interest rate risk at play there with the timing of the AAA structure. Because I guess there's a big prepay or not. Kind of delayed pay, right? So if you, uh-huh. you could, there's implicit interest rate risk over whether you're the first principal of the AAA to be repaid or the latter, right? And so that may be kind
I
of
mean
a,
within the AAA? Mm-hmm. I think there's only one BBB. Within the AAA, so I don't know if they did this. Like, you know, in an auto loan securitization, they have time tranches. You know, there's a money market trust that first gets all of the money, and then there's a 1 year, and then there's a 2 year. And so it's possible they use that model in student loans. I just don't know. So I think most of the private financial institutions, you know, Sallie Mae and then the banks and what have you, would have probably used a senior sub, again, with maybe an auction rate tranche or two for cash flow reasons.
Uh-huh. So they'd use the over-collateralization for credit enhancement as opposed
well,
to any credit guarantee?
The thing that's funny in the government-guaranteed loans is that they were usually under-collateralized, not over-collateralized.
That's right.
Uh-huh. That's why the auction rate guys ran into trouble, because they were under-collateralized.
Huh.
They would issue... This is, again, I think more of an auction rate phenomenon and not... I don't know if it was a senior sub, but they would routinely issue $103 of notes backed by $100 of loans. And that's why the auction rate securities have become such a problem in student loan space is this under collateralization.
And how did that get rated then? I thought in this space these were SPEs created by Sallie and these other entities. So it wasn't, the structured securities represented not claims on Sally, but claims on the SPE created
by
Sally. And so then if you've got an under-collateralized pool, then it seems like there's going to be inherently going to be losses for the security holders.
Well, and again, this wasn't something I think that financial institutions did. This was much more contained. See, now I have this problem every time. The Brazoses of the world. I think I'm just going to use another example. I'm just going to say FIA and stop tripping up. It was where it became a problem was the auction rate. And I think the idea was these were rich enough loans. So some of the older ones, you know, they had a government subsidy. So there was enough cash flow coming in that over time you could build up to parity. So more cash flow was coming in from the student loans.
Oh, these might have been premium loans in terms of the interest rate.
Uh-huh.
That might be why they were under-collateralized. They weren't under-collateralized in present value terms, but just in principal terms.
Right.
Ah, okay. So, but they're not economically under-collateralized. It's just principal.
Right. So they assumed there was enough cash coming in. There was more cash coming in from the loans than was being paid out to bondholders. So they would use that excess spread over time to build up to parity. But the problem was when the auctions failed before a note had gotten to parity. That's when it became a problem.
While you're pausing, let me get in that this conversation is covered by our confidentiality agreement. I don't think I need to say that, but I feel better when I do.
Okay, well, thanks for that. Thanks. Yeah. Right, thanks. I needed to pause anyway to finish writing. Now, the Brazoses of the world were the. It regularly issue crate structures. I forgot what you called them before. It's like a separate trust or
a master trust.
A master trust.
Yep.
Issue securities in the master trust. It would be under collateralized, at least in terms of principal amount. Maybe mm-hmm. not in terms of present value.
Right.
Because they might have been premium loans.
Yeah.
And you said that is where some of that structure would issue long-term securities, and part of it might issue an auction rate security?
Yeah, so let me just as a framing device, it's helpful to think of two types of issuers, issuers that have easy access to capital and issuers that don't. And so issuers that had good access to capital, you know, like Sallie Mae has good access to the capital markets, I think those issues, and a couple of the big banks, they would mostly use kind of very traditional securitization structures, like that you'd see for other asset classes. Discrete trust, you know, and so there's a big difference. Do you know the difference between a discrete trust and a master trust?
No, I do not.
So a discrete trust is something that auto loans use, for example. And so say if you used Ford Credit's my usual example, and I think of it as, you know, Ford Credit makes a bunch of auto loans. They put them in an SPV or SPE or whatever, and then they kind of let it go. Do you know what I mean? Like, those loans are in there. It goes off.
They're not replenished. It's not
nothing. There's obviously a servicer relationship, but they don't put in new loans. You know, those loans just pay down and do what they're going to do. And so a Sallie Mae would do something like that. You know, there would be a set pool of loans, mm-hmm. and they would go off into the ether. And it'd be a fairly standard securitization structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now what the state, I call them quasi-nonprofits, they would use a master trust structure. And that's similar to the credit card structure. And so if you think of the credit card securitization problem, right, a credit card receivable is really only 1 month long. Right? Like, each billing cycle is a new receivable. Like, in the credit card world, each month they're extending you a new loan. And so, obviously, you can't securitize one-month loans, right? It would just be way too fast. So, instead, they have kind of, I always think it was like kind of like a big cauldron that they're always putting loans into on a regular mm-hmm. basis and taking them in and out. And then there's a whole series of notes that are all issued jointly against that pot. As opposed to the auto loan discrete trust world, right, where there's a set of loans that belong to each security, In the master trust world, you have one big jumble of loans that are collateralizing lots of securities.
So it's
not one-to-one matching.
Yep. So it would be safe to say that the discrete trust is sort of a fixed model, whereas, or a static model, whereas the master trust is more of a dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, it really has to
it's
do with...
It's a perpetuity principle, right? In that you've got the same principle outstanding the whole time. There's no amortization.
Well, that's a feature of the notes, right, that they tend to be these things, soft bullets, where you get something at the end. But, I mean, you tend to use the master trust in cases where you have very short maturity loans. So credit cards, dealer floor plan. Like, you know, if you're an auto dealer, you get a loan from the manufacturer against each car on the lot. And so normally you hold a car for 45 days. So the life of a floor plan receivable is 45 days. You know, it's like a credit card is 30 days. So it doesn't make sense. You have to keep replenishing.
Yeah.
And there's something else called premium finance. Like businesses can get a loan to pay their insurance, which is collateralized by their premium payments, and those tend to be short-term loans. So they use they use master trust structures. Whereas things that are long-term, you know, mortgages, student loans, auto loans, tend to use this discrete trust thing, where you just set aside a pool of loans and send them out.
Right, it's more static.
Mm-hmm. And so I don't know actually why. So it's a little unusual actually why they used a master trust for student loans, which is a long. I don't know the answer to that.
I think because they get consolidated and there is some refi going on.
There is a lot of refinancing.
That may be why you'd want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just want to say, I'm selling securities on an X dollar amount of debt.
Yeah.
And it's government guaranteed. I haven't ever looked into how you allocate credit losses on that, but you could.
Well, you're foreshadowing the problem, right? So the big problem of a master trust structure, as I understand it, is that, like, so the discrete trust structure, say that security goes bad. Like, you know, you put those auto loans in there and they are all awful. Well, that security may do terribly, but it has no effect on the rest of your securities out there. But with a master trust, when one goes bad, it affects all of them because they're all collateralized by the same pool of loans. And so that was a big problem for these guys because...
So, for
auto loans, right? I said in auto loans, so you made auto loans. They were terrible. You know, everybody in the pool lost their job. Nobody can pay their auto loans. They all went into default. You know, the rating agencies downgrade your security. Terrible things happen to it. It doesn't have any effect on the rest of your securities.
Right.
And they're separate. They're like legally separate.
Oh, because, you know, like I have 2A and I issue 2A securities. I have 2B, I have 2B securities, and so on and so forth. So what happens in A doesn't necessarily affect B.
Right. Like you made another pool of loans. They were to people who all kept their jobs. Everybody repaid. Your bad security doesn't affect your good security.
In terms of the structuring of these discrete trusts, how homogenous are the different, I'm just going to call them tubes, and we just pack them all into
mm-hmm.
this, you know, closed-end structure, mm-hmm. and then we issue securities from there. So to what degree are they homogenous? You know, am I going to say, okay, like Ford Auto Co., are these going to be, you know, Ford F-150s from Albuquerque? Ford F-150s from Dallas, or is it going to be, you know, Ford from all over the United States in this period of time? Like, how much commonality is there in terms of the security mm-hmm. they put in?
The idea is that it's supposed to be kind of a random selection of what you have on your book at that time.
Okay, but usually the same general maturity space, general...
Uh-huh.
Structure, is that correct? Or
yeah, well, they'll release for each security. They'll give you some characteristics of the pool. You know, they'll say, this is the distribution of FICO scores for the people in the pool.
Okay.
This is the distribution of loan terms. This is the distribution of interest rates. They'll give you some information so you can judge, you know, whether it's a representative thing of Ford's, you know, Ford's auto pools, for example.
So, Karen, can you tell us how the master trust ended up sort of tying the value of the securities together across trusts?
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, again, I'm not a securitization lawyer, so I'm just going to give you my idea, which is the collateral there is not a fixed pool of loans, right? So, say you could have, say, 10 or 20 notes, and they all share one collateral pool. There's not a set number of loans. And I believe they have these cross-default clauses, where like if one security defaults, it may constitute an event of default for the others. I'm getting out of my depth here, but there are these cross-linkages between securities if they're in a master trust structure that you don't have in a discrete trust structure.
Well, I would think since it's kind of a managed flow of debt in and out of the structure, then it would be harder to allocate the losses. Say, oh, this credit card bankruptcy, or whatever you want to call it, occurred securities issued from this trust as opposed to that trust, because maybe even that borrower appeared in different places at different times. And, and so it's not as inextricably, uniquely linked to one security versus another across the life of the borrower's borrowing.
Well, exactly. In fact, it's not at all, right? Though that one borrower, to use your example, does collateralize all the securities because it's the whole pool. So-and-so's student loan is collateral for everything jointly. It's not just for one note.
I see. So even after you buy the security, they could lower their credit card standards and kind of, even if you did your due diligence and you analyzed the pool when you bought the security, the pool could change in quality over time.
Right. That's why there's all sorts. That's why, you know, securitization lawyers get paid a lot of money to make sure that you can only put certain things in.
I don't know what you're referring to. no, there really aren't many securitization lawyers anymore because, I mean, it's been, as you know, the market's been relatively dead for the past few years. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, but just, I'm still
there is some justice. All right. Okay, sorry, Karen, I interrupted myself. So you have, let's say, a pool of $100 million, to make a round number, of student loans, and you might have three master trusts, right?
No, you just have one master trust.
Oh.
You have three notes.
And then three
securities. But even take, you know, credit cards. You know,
JP
Morgan just has one master trust for all of its credit cards.
Oh, okay.
Citibank actually has two because they split their retail cards off. But most banks even banks with, you know, $100 billion credit card portfolios will just have one master trust. And there'll be lots of securities issued against that trust.
Are those securities have a maturity or on them? And how do you...
I think there's generally like a... Yeah, I'm getting out of my depth. I think there's like a five-year limit or something, but I couldn't tell you.
So... Do they then just at one point issue all they're going to issue of that 5-year security, or they reopen the issue, or how does the thing grow over time?
They just keep issuing new securities against it.
I see, with different maturities?
Yeah, well, as one note matures, so you have one 5-year note out to investors, and as that one matures, you issue a new 5-year note against the master trust.
I see, I haven't ever thought of this before, so it seems kind of odd that you buy the security and then later they issue some more debt. So now am I junior or am I at least diluted? Or
no, they're all pari passu. They're all equal. They're all equal claim, I believe, on the collateral.
Right, but now I've got more claims, and unless I'm confident that there's an equal increment of collateral, then I'm being diluted in a sense, right? So just like your General Motors keeps selling new shares, it's the same firm, you know, you're being diluted. So unless they only issue the new securities when there's more credit card debt in the pool, then I'm being diluted. So I have to make sure that the new securities match on favorable terms the incremental assets in the pool, and that the incremental assets are comparable or better quality than when I bought the security, or I'm not, you know, or I'm looking at a very uncertain future because of that, the perpetuity of the trust and my rather finite kind of claim on that trust, and that it's not only is it rolling over in terms of the debt in it and the people in it, but you know, even the claims on it are rolling. So both on the asset and the liability side, it's a moving target for me.
Yeah, that's why the issuer has to hold this big seller's interest piece, which is a vertical slice. So they have to hold. So the trusts are typically very over collateralized, and the issuer has to hold a good chunk of it.
I see. That may either way, they smooth all those concerns.
Right, because they need to, as you're saying, they need to have kind of a buffer with so much churning going on.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, I'm sorry to interrupt you, though, but this is very helpful. So you were saying that these were the sort of nonprofit state-sponsored corporations were issuing a lot of securities based on a master trust arrangement. They had government guaranteed student loans in them.
As the collateral.
And they were, you think, and these were under and not over collateralized, unlike our credit card friends that were over collateralized, these were under collateralized.
Well, for the credit card guys, I was saying the master trust as a whole is over collateralized, mm-hmm. which is different from a given note being over collateralized or under collateralized. Mm-hmm. So, yes, a given note, and I agree this doesn't seem consistent with my saying it's a master trust, but there would be $100 in assets in loans, and it must be some sort of pro rata allotment of what was in the master trust, collateralizing a note that had a face value of 103.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the idea being that the excess spread over time would bring you up to 103.
Right, right.
But then when the auctions failed, then there wasn't enough excess spread to bring it to parity.
Okay, that's where we need to get back to our narrative then. So these master trusts were generating securities. Some of them were soft bullet or other more conventional securities, and
well,
some
they were auction rates.
Oh, they're all.
They were mostly auction rate. I think they did have some variable rate demand notes also for VRDOs. I guess the obligation VRDNs. And they tend to.
But they funded the whole master trust.
Well, those were securities issued by the master trust. The master trust issues securities.
Right, but it issued also some. The master trust also issued some conventional securities as well.
I think they issued some VRDNs also.
So ARS, VRDO, but any kind of conventional.
Congressional preferreds, anything like that.
I don't think so, but again, you're getting beyond. I haven't looked at the prospectuses that carefully.
Okay. There's just, you know,
but when they, but the issuers, I've not heard issuers come in. They talk about the auction rate and they talk about the variable rate demand note. And I think looking at them, there weren't a lot of fixed rate notes. But I mean, you'd have to look at a prospectus to be sure.
So.
So the other important thing, going back to my organizational framework, the reason they set it up this way is because they didn't have capital, right? So that's how you should think of the world, the institutions that had capital and the ones that didn't. And it was the ones that didn't that used this framework for the
right.
most part.
But if you didn't have capital and you were under-collateralizing the trust...
No, you're under-collateralizing the security. You're not under-collateralizing the trust.
Oh, okay. So the master trust is maybe over collateralized?
It could be. I just don't know. But I don't think it follows. I'm just saying as a matter of logic that because the note was under collateralized, the master trust was. I assume the master trust was not, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. So the security was under collateralized?
Yes.
You're sure of that?
Yes. The securities were under collateralized. It varied. But it was standard for them to be under collateralized.
And there was no credit enhancement. No monoline wrap, no CDS, no other way to that these state-sponsored corporations were providing additional credit guarantee, sort of to supplement what the 3% mm-hmm. cut on the government guarantee and any time delay. In other words, you might, just like we saw with a lot of the AAA-rated mortgage-backed securities,
right.
the when they would be sold by the issuer, like in Lehman, they would be sold with a credit default swap on them.
Right.
So you get a AAA security, and for an extra 7 or 8 basis points, you get a further credit guarantee
yep.
from AIG or whoever you're buying it from.
Yep.
And so I was thinking, okay, this is a case where... I don't know if these were rated AAA.
Yes, they were all rated AAA.
All rated AAA? I guess that's right, because a government guarantee would have got you at least very close to AAA. Right?
Yes. Now, I always use the auction rate security example as a point that, you know, AAA-rated collateral does not necessarily mean a AAA-rated structure. You know, you can do crazy things with the structure, too. You know, it's kind of, there's a layer of structuring. Yeah, I just don't know about the monoline. I never really looked into that. It wouldn't surprise me if they used it, but I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, because the monoline credit wrap was normally guaranteeing prompt.
Uh-huh.
Prompt and full payment. So at least that's the way they did the muni,
yep.
The conventional muni debt. Anyway.
Yep.
So I just wanted to.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, I just don't know.
Okay, so in this case, they've got what sounds like a AAA auction rate security,
mm-hmm.
and it's by dint above the structure because it's got subordination,
mm-hmm.
and because it's ultimately government guaranteed debt,
mm-hmm.
Which even on present value terms is probably good for 90-95% anyway.
Yep.
And but so then what? So I guess the under collateralization came to bite when people realized that if the auction fails, they don't have the assets since it's under collateralized. It's not worth 100%. It's not worth par. Is that?
Well, when the auctions failed, and so the auctions failed for good, as you know, in February 2008. Then they had to start paying out the penalty rate of interest. And with the penalty rate of interest, it was no longer true, right? The thing that made the whole thing work is that the payments coming in from students were more than what had to be paid out to bondholders. And you used that excess to get up to parity. Once you're paying a penalty interest rate, it's no longer true that what's coming in from students is that much greater than what you're paying out to bondholders, that you have an excess spread to get back to parity. So that's when it started to bite.
That's when the profitability of the master trust began to bite, because the auction had already failed.
Well, that's when the situation in which you would suffer a principal loss. Because there's no way then for the trust, for the note to get to parity. Because it doesn't, the excess spread is gone.
Yeah, because now you've gone from a case where you had a positive cash flow that was going to build up
right.
equity over time, or
what
they call collateralization over time.
Yeah.
And now you got a negative cash flow because the penalty rate exceeds the interest rate on the note, even if it was a premium student loan that's more premium than that. And so, I see. So then you're actually further under collateralizing or decollateralizing the.
Well, you just don't get to 100.
Yeah.
So if you have, you know, I said 100 to 103 or 97 to 100, you just can't make it that extra bit because you're paying out the penalty rates.
Because people were buying these things with the understanding that this excess spread would need to be maintained for this instrument to hold value. But they were still okay with investing in this because the theory that, oh, well, it's still government guaranteed. Is that the position of investors?
Well, I think it was more, it was only a problem if the auctions failed.
And that's obviously the writing on the wall for everything was sort of, oh, well, it never happens. It never, you know,
uh-huh.
It'll never happen. Is that sort of the theory behind it?
And there's a very nice Congressional Research Service report that you might find useful to read on the auction rate securities. It's by a guy named Andrew Austin, and he's written a very nice history of the auction rate securities and the background with them with Wall Street. And as you probably know, there's been a ton of litigation and, you know, attempts to resolve the situation.
Now, but what this leaves is an interesting conundrum then, because if there was no monoline wrap, then the monolines in this instance are not the not a factor in causing the auctions to fail. So what's your interpretation of what caused the auctions to fail?
But you weren't sure if there was a monoline wrap, right?
Yeah, I just can't speak to the monoline.
What? Okay.
Uh-huh.
So, right, I understood that. Barring that then as an explanatory factor, do you have any other thoughts on why you think the auctions failed?
Yeah, and there's a nice description of this in the Congressional Research Service report. So I point you to that as the authoritative. I can give you a kind of Cliff Notes version, which is, as you know, there's only implicit liquidity support in an auction rate security. It's not like the VRDNs, which have explicit support through a letter of credit. there's just implicit support from the fact that the dealers would generally support the auctions if there weren't enough bids. So as you know, how they work is every 28 or every 35 or in some cases every 7 days, but I think it was more 28 days in student loans. You know, people who had the securities could either say they wanted to hold it or they wanted to buy more or they wanted to sell, and then they would reset. And if there wasn't quite enough demand, as much as there was supply, the dealers would step in to make the auctions work. And then I think as the, you know, kind of financial crisis was building, people got more and more skittish about the auctions. The dealers had to buy more and more, and then there came a point where they just didn't want to be holding all that, and they stopped supporting the auctions.
So it was on the theory that, you know, not all ARSs are created equal, but the ARS is off one market. Once one part starts to falter, then all of a sudden people just get nervous with the whole thing, and then that caused the ripple effect, I guess you could say. Does that make sense?
What caused them to be skittish about the securities?
Well, it's this. So if the auction fails,
before the auction failed.
But why you would be skittish, right? Is that you bought? So a lot of the people that bought these were like corporate treasurers, and they thought they were buying the equivalent of a money market fund, but with a little bit more interest, right?
So and it's tax exempt, right?
Some of them are tax exempt, some aren't.
Oh, I thought these were all tax exempt. Brazos and these guys were tax-exempt entities.
They got a share of Texas's tax bond allotment, but it wasn't enough. So they would tend to leverage. So maybe to make up a number, so like 10% maybe of their issuance would actually be tax-exempt.
Okay.
Something in more in that magnitude.
I should have asked that earlier.
Because they used it. If you talk to them, they'll say they leveraged their tax-exempt allotment. But it wasn't big enough. For all their issuance. And so you bought this and you thought you had like a money market fund but with a little bit more return. But if the auction fails, and what's happened is your money market-like fund becomes a 30-year fixed bond paying a low rate of interest, you know, lower than other 30-rate bonds out there.
Depending on which security you bought, though, because sometimes if the auction fails and continues to fail, yeah, I've got my hands on a 30-year asset, but if it's got penalty rates of 8-9%, well then...
Yes, so the municipal bond ones had high penalty rates. The student loan ones had very low penalty rates of interest rates because there was only so much, the underlying assets coming in, they wanted to make sure it wouldn't run out of cash. So they put a cap on what the payouts could be, and that cap was pretty low.
Do you recall roughly what kind of ranges we're talking about?
2 to 4 to 5%. And some of them set to zero for a while. Because when the auctions first ran into trouble, the dealer, they asked the rating agencies for a period, could they lift the cap for a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
So that they weren't paying these low interest rates, and they got permission to lift the caps for a little bit, but there was a limit on how much. If the cap was over, then you had to compensate later by going down to zero to make it average out over the period.
So that was where the waivers came into play, and they had to stop getting waivers, so it eaten to the actual value of the principal.
They could only do waivers for
right.
a couple months, otherwise it was too much.
Okay.
So then, nobody wants to be left holding a, you know, as now, right? The investors are not happy about holding a, you know, what could be a 20 or 30 year asset paying 3% when you thought you had put your money in something very liquid that was like a money market account that you could get your money out of any 28 days, but you pick up a little extra yield.
But what we haven't really explained, I think, is prior to the auctions becoming disrupted, why did the investors... the auctions got disrupted in part because investors reduced their demand for these instruments. Why did they reduce their demand for these instruments?
I think they started getting... They just got squeamish that the auctions would fail. And if you read this Andrew Austin piece, he really does a very nice job of delineating... how there were some investors in advance who said this is not a good setup.
So it
was, they just didn't realize it when they bought it initially. Now they start looking at it more critically or something and said, oh, what am I doing here? These auction rates, these auction resets are not a reliable source of liquidity. Is that kind
this
of
is to the extent that you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm kind of, I feel like I'm going more into speculation here.
Let me rephrase the question, perhaps. So you have different segments of the ARS market.
Yeah.
Were corporate treasurers agnostic, or were they, you know, I mean, obviously, obviously for those who are looking for taxes, it would have been munis, but the non-muni ARSs,
uh-huh.
you know, they had other, there are other different types. Were they agnostic in terms of what kind of ARSs they went into, or some saying, I want to go into student loans, I want to go into CDOs, I want to go into Ds? Because that would impact the theory that behind the notion that, okay, there's trouble in the overall ARS market, therefore, since I'm agnostic to which ARSs I invest in, I just want to get out of the whole thing. Whereas if it's, you know, oh, there's trouble specifically in the student loan market. Does that make sense?
Again, if you know.
Yeah, I don't think I know enough about, I mean, I just think investors vary in their sophistication. And these were very complicated documents. But I think I just don't know enough. But there is, you know, out there in the public record, you know, a huge trove of litigation documents. You know, like the New York Attorney General, for example, litigated, so which could support, you know, give more information.
So I guess on some of those suits, they in the background part of the suit, they would describe this process. And
mm-hmm.
That's something we can get right.
It's funny enough, I've gone on the OAG for New York website and I haven't found them.
Hmm.
They've cited to them in various pieces, and I've copied and pasted the links in there, and the links are no longer there. My guess is that perhaps due to the settlements, they may have scrubbed them from the website. I don't know. I haven't been able to find them. Might you happen to have copies on file?
No, but again, this Andrew Austin thing's good.
No, I know.
I know, but of the documents.
Like, I've looked at the Andrew Austin piece.
Oh, you have?
Right.
Have you looked at his most recent one? Because he's updated it 3 times.
Oh, has he? I don't know if I've seen the most updated one, but I do
okay.
know that the I've literally gone to the footnotes, clicked over with my
okay.
eyes, dragged, copied, and pasted, so that's why I'm wondering. It,
uh-huh.
It hasn't showed up on the OAG's website.
Okay.
So that's, and I've typed, and I've also tried typing into Google, and I haven't been able to find it, so
uh-huh.
I was wondering if you might happen to have me.
If you come up with something, we'll let you know.
Okay.
You
yeah.
have some additional.
Because I've looked around for certain litigation documents, and uh-huh. so far I haven't had much luck with them.
No, I don't have, because okay. it is a state matter, so, you know. Yeah. I mean, the New York litigation was.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, then you know as much as I do, since I'm just recapping what I read. And I mean, I've
well,
talked
I might have read through most of the one. I think I might have looked at it at one point a year or more ago. We'll talk. We'll call up the guy at CRS and get him on the phone and talk to him as well.
Sure. Yeah, just he was asking for the most recent copy.
Yeah.
Well, again, I mean, we're looking for the litigation documents.
Uh-huh.
Not so much because again, I can copy a link, but if the link doesn't work, then it's
uh-huh.
not
it's frustrating.
It's useless. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question about the knock-on effect. So then, when these state-sponsored student loan originators couldn't fund themselves. Then presumably they stopped making student loans, or they
correct?
They reduced.
They had because the other problem was the capital, right? All of their capital was in that master trust. They didn't have access. They didn't have money outside. So all of their assets were frozen in these master trust auction rate securities. So they couldn't make student loans and they couldn't buy student loans. And again, they were more important as secondary market institutions than primary market institutions.
Right, but other people, in, as we saw, kind of with housing in some sense,
yeah.
What really stopped the show in part was the ability to kind of move it along. It didn't occur first at the origination, but it occurred in the warehousing or pipeline to securitization, which is where the credit crunch started hitting. Really as a result of the, I think probably as much of the problems with the leverage loans at that mm-hmm. wholesale level financing. So here's what sounds like a comparable case, that there's a disruption in the wholesale level financing that hits the state-sponsored entities that are so critical for that portion of the market. And then they're not going to buy them from the loan originators, and so they're going to curtail or reduce their origination.
Correct.
And so then, how did, you know, so what happened that fall at school?
Well, there were a couple coincident problems in the student loan market. I think you alluded to them in your original question. that you sent over. And as you said, in either, I think it took effect August 2007, maybe it was July, Congress cut the subsidies on student loans. And they cut the subsidies to the extent that it was still profitable to make a student loan, but the underlying assumption, if you kind of look at the math and think of it, there were two underlying assumptions. One was that asset-backed securities could still be issued at a spread of 10 basis points, because pre-crisis, right, a AAA student loan security was traded 10 basis points over three-month LIBOR. And so there was sort of an assumption when they're telling the lenders how much, you know, they're going to get for a student loan that they're going to be able to fund at LIBOR, three-month LIBOR plus 10 basis points. And that part of the equation became not true as the securitization markets came under stress. And then the second thing that happened was that the historically tight relationship between the three-month commercial paper rate and the three-month LIBOR rate became apart. So they used to be within 10 basis points. And then when the interbank funding markets came under so much stress, you know, LIBOR went up quite a bit and the commercial paper rate stayed very low. And so what issuers were paying out on their loans, which was LIBOR, what they were paying to investors, was much more than what was coming into the trust, which were loans tied to the three-month commercial paper rate.
Okay, that's what I don't exactly understand. So you were talking about originators here?
Yes, so you asked what was the effect of... Everybody's saying it's hard to... I think the failure of the auction rate securities was not the main problem. It was the I think other originators would have stepped in.
Could I ask you step back just a second
before
the next point? So then, the originators are LIBOR is important for them, I suppose, because that's how they fund the loan until they can sell it in the secondary market. Is it?
Well, they would like, for example, now I'm thinking more of like a Sallie Mae, which securitizes its own loans. So there's some banks. Some banks sell to secondary market institutions. Some originate and hold and securitize. But whoever they're selling them to is going to fund at LIBOR, except for the auction.
Until they can accumulate enough to...
Well, the securitizations are tied to LIBOR. For the, I mean, the auction rate was not the... So the auction rate market at its peak was something like $80 billion, right? But the securitized student loan market, is a very rough guess, was maybe $300 billion. So the bulk of it was not auction rate. The bulk of it was, you know, Sallie Mae has a securitization book of something like 120 to 150 billion. There are some other players that have, you know, good sized portfolios. And those non-auction rate are all securitizing at 3 month LIBOR.
Oh, so those are all floating rate.
They're all floating rate. They're tied to 3 month LIBOR.
Are students making variable rate interest payments on their student debt?
It depends.
I thought
not now. They're not now. Right now it's fixed at 6.8 maybe, something like that. Rates are fixed now, but they were historically floating rate. But it didn't matter because from an issuer's perspective, what the student paid was irrelevant, right? You got paid the government reimbursement rate. So you got paid the three-month commercial paper rate plus a spread.
I see. So that for the federal guaranteed part.
For the federal guaranteed. And if three-month commercial paper plus, one of them was like 119 basis points, if that was more than what the student was paying, then the federal government gave you the difference. And if it was less, then you remitted it to the federal government.
I'm sorry, I was writing when you started saying that.
So you got paid, your payment was commercial paper rate plus a spread. And so if the student borrowing rate was less, then the federal government made up the difference to get you to 3 month CP plus whatever. And if the student, what the student was paying was more, you had to give the difference to the federal government. So you didn't really care so much what the student was paying you. As roughly speaking, there were some older loans where you got to keep part of that. There's this floor income thing, but for practical purposes, you can just think of it as you didn't care about what the student.
I said you're a servicer and you gave the, you either got the deficiency or you paid out the surplus to the government.
Right, but either way, you just got 3 months CP plus
okay.
whatever.
So you got a huge basis risk between the CP and LIBOR.
Well, historically, no. But then during the financial crisis, yes.
Well, you got $300 billion of it, roughly. Or in this case, $220 billion of it. So it may not be a large magnitude of risk, but you've got a lot of it.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And historically, it had always, they'd always been very tightly tied together at 10 basis points.
So the originators hold a basis risk between CP and LIBOR.
Yes. For the government-guaranteed loans. The private student loans, which we talked about earlier, tended to be tied to prime, and now they're tied to LIBOR. But for the government-guaranteed, you had a CP-LIBOR basis risk.
I see. So too, I guess, when you're, if you sell the loan off, then it's a final sale. It's bought by Brazos, they throw it into a security, right? And that may be part of what is the justification for the under-collateralization, and that brought the, going into the master trust is the commercial paper plus the spread by the federal government, mm-hmm. right? And what's going out is an auction rate payment or a variable rate or a LIBOR-based payment to investors.
Mm-hmm.
And so that basis risk is sort of priced in in part as an under-collateralization, I guess.
Yeah, although, again, I don't think the master trust was under-collateralized, just the notes were under-collateralized. I don't know one way or another
about
the
master
trust.
How could it be otherwise? If the notes are under-collateralized, the master trust would have to be under-collateralized.
I don't know the answer to this. You agree you've stumped me. I'm just basing on my analogy from the credit card world, which is where I think they took it from, and that in the credit card world, there's this seller's interest. Makes me think there must have been a similar analog, but I don't know the answer to your question. I just can't stipulate that
I think that's a perfectly satisfying answer to me. I don't expect you to know everything, and when you're not held responsible for an error.
Okay.
We're not hiring you, and we're not evaluating.
Okay.
We're just trying to understand this, and you know more than we do, so you're helping us out.
I know. I just don't want to lodge the wrong idea in your brain.
Yeah. No, but you've served us very well about highlighting something we do want to drill into a bit more.
Okay.
In which case, if you want, we'll tell you if we find out more, right?
Okay,
if
that'd be great.
If you would like to know more, we'd be glad to help you out, because you're helping us out today. So this is getting kind of better in a way, but slightly different than our hypothesis was.
So the student loan is inordinately complicated given the size of the market. So there's this basis risk that the rating agencies didn't really price until after the crisis. So, you know, Moody's and S&P issued guidance kind of revising their stress case for.
Well, that's what killed the munis, too, in part. You know, they're always, even if the auction rate hadn't blown up,
mm-hmm.
you still always had this basis risk between your borrowing at your idiosyncratic muni bond rate, if it's auction rate or VRDO, and you're swapping into either LIBOR or SIFMA. So you've always got basis risk there between the index and your idiosyncratic debt service. And they didn't, I don't think, price that in very well. I mean, I've talked to some of the financial advisors and they said we never recommended a synthetic fixed funding arrangement unless there was 50 basis points worth of meat on the bone, because we did realize there were a risk. And, and I'm like going, why 50 basis points? I mean, what, not 49, what, not 51? What is that, just adding out of the air? We sort of stuck with so yeah, it was out of the air, right? It's some number that they grabbed that sounded prudent, right? Which is better than no standard, but it's it was arbitrary as opposed to result with some careful analysis of what the market price of, you know, that basis risk was. So it sounds like there was a little bit of that similar thing going on here, that the banks had been. Just they're kind of nibbling off of, because it was mostly working in their favor, because I guess the spread over commercial paper was sweet enough that they're picking up a little bit between that and LIBOR, right?
Well, I think it was more that it had just always been stable. You know, so if you think, I forget one or the other, there was a 10 basis point difference between the two. I can't remember which one was higher. But it had been 10 basis points for a long time, so people just didn't worry about the basis risk. They thought it was a little bit more stable than it turned out to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess at least with commercial paper, you're comparing two indices. It was probably commercial paper index, probably the one the Fed collects, or?
Right, it's the one that we publish on the, it's either the H8 or the H15, I can't remember which release.
We work with a guy who used to do that for you, so we'll tease him about that. Okay, that's all very helpful. So then that's when, in those rates blew out, then the whole scheme starts. So then that starts really hitting the mortgage originators as well.
Right, so if you think about it, so Congress, there's what's coming in, which is CP plus X, and that has to be greater than LIBOR plus Y. You know, you're coming in as a CP plus X, it's coming out as LIBOR plus Y. And so then Congress assumed, they said, okay, well, CP plus LIBOR, that's always going to be 10 basis points, and these guys are always going to be able to fund the securitization markets at LIBOR plus 10, say. So if you have those two assumptions about how the world works, and then you back out, what does X have to be? You know, what spread do I have to give the issuer over the 3-month CP rate so, you know, it's just profitable enough for them want to participate? And so that, so Congress set X at that level under the assumption that CP plus LIBOR would be around 10 basis points, and that they could fund at LIBOR plus 10.
What had it been before?
Well, that's what it was pre-crisis. Both those assumptions were true because Congress cut the subsidies.
I thought you said there was a cut. So
right, so Congress rethought the subsidies. It went into effect either July or August of 2007, mm-hmm. and the new subsidies, which were quite a bit lower, worked as long as the difference between CP and LIBOR was 10 basis points and as long as you could access funding at 10 basis points over LIBOR.
So you don't quite recall the formula they went to, but it was...
I do remember. It was like commercial 3-month commercial paper plus 134 basis points, I think. Uh-huh. It was a little bit more for the nonprofits, you know, the FIAs of the world. They got a little bit more... I don't remember exactly, but it's well published. I mean, you know, it's in the code.
Yeah.
One of them was CP plus 134, but I don't remember. There are different rates for consolidation loans, which is a refinanced loan, as opposed to originations and those made by the state nonprofits.
Yeah. So did that help or hurt the quantity of new student loan issuance?
Right. So if you think of the timelines, you think of Congress. They're going to cut the subsidy. They cut the subsidy, and when they cut the subsidy, they're imagining a world where there's these two 10 basis point differentials. And so they set X. And they did that right before the financial crisis. And then the financial crisis hits, and both of those assumptions are no longer true. Right? The spread between commercial paper and LIBOR, which was 10 basis points, on some days spikes to 200 basis points. And whereas you could fund at LIBOR plus 10, now you have to fund at LIBOR plus 400. So in the new financial crisis world, the math doesn't work anymore. There's no longer enough money coming in from the program, which is based on these pre-crisis assumptions about financial markets, to cover now what your cost of funds is, now that LIBOR is so much higher than CP, and now that the securitization markets are...
So now the loan subsidy, the federal subsidy is unprofitable, and you can't securitize it anyway.
Yeah. Well, so you literally can't make student loans. It's not profitable. Like, the money coming in is substantially less than your cost of funds to fund it. So you literally, I mean, you know, why would you make the loan if you lose money from day one?
I see. That's what killed the non-auction rate security.
Well, killed everybody. It hit the auction rate guys, too, right? Because they had the same CP LIBOR.
Right. Yeah.
They had the same problems.
So does this explain why in the fall of 2007 people at my law school were having difficulty accessing student loans?
Yes, that's why people were having trouble accessing.
So that's why the loan checks just weren't coming and the university kept saying, we're getting there, we're getting there, we're getting there.
Yes.
I'm speaking from personal perspective, so.
That's the, I can't speak about what the particular mechanism that failed, but that was the broader landscape of why things, okay. There are problems.
Now, had there ever been major dislocations between LIBOR and commercial paper recently, or is that just a new phenomenon?
To the best of my knowledge, there had not been previously.
And in terms of, I'm just looking at the time clock we've got.
Yeah, that's off. I shouldn't tell you that.
That's a bar clock. I've been here before.
Oh, okay.
It's like 15 minutes early.
Oh.
Yeah, they've been apparently doing some drinking here late at night.
Never mind.
I shouldn't have told you that, but go ahead.
I knew it. So where did we go in, let's say, September and October of 2008? You know, once some of the spikes had narrowed a little bit.
Well, that's why Congress then passed this legislation known as a CASELA.
Known as a what now?
Well, it's called a CASELA, E-C-A-S-L-A, which stands for something like Ensuring Continued Access to Student Loan Act or something like that. And that's what gave the Department of Education the power to purchase loans. They couldn't purchase consolidation loans, but they could purchase new loan originations. I'd also like to plead for a bathroom break, if we could.
Take a break.
Take a short break.
In addition to the cut in subsidies to the federally guaranteed student loan program and some of the problems with the auction and security market, were there any other factors that you can think of that contributed to the contraction of student loan origination in 2007 and 2008?
Well, it was the combination, right? I mean, the congressional cuts themselves would not have been an issue if it hadn't been for the financial markets, right? I mean, it was because they were based on assumptions that were no longer true,
right,
once the financial crisis.
So the change of policy wasn't so fundamentally unsound as that it was, the timing was very unfortunate.
Right.
Because of the, as you say, as you put it, the premise of it was no longer true.
Right.
But then again, the premise of the old program wouldn't have been true either. So the only difference would have been that it had built in a fatter spread under the old program.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a question then of whether the older, the higher subsidy from before still might or might not have been sufficient to.
Right. Right. You might recall there were a wave of scandals before then of administrators at schools getting kickbacks. And so there, at the time, there was quite a lot of furor in the popular press.
And it also generated some extremely high profits for some of the banks, too, somehow. I don't remember exactly why, but I think there was a concern that the student loan program was a little too profitable given the amount of risk that they were taking on.
Yeah, I can't comment to that, but it seems plausible.
Well, I think this helps very much. I want to say, but I know these other guys had some questions as well.
Do you want to have something?
Yeah. So, in 5 minutes or less, where have we gone from, let's say, March and April of 2008 to where we are today?
So I was starting to tell you about a CASELA.
Right. Exactly.
Which was the legislation that gave the Department of Education the power to purchase student loans. Originated between October 1st, 2003 through, I think, June 30th, 2009. They may have extended the end date, that's why I'm a little fuzzy. And the Department of Education, you know, used that authority very creatively. They set up some, you know, very, very nice programs that really kept student loan originations going. You know, and obviously the Department of Education and Treasury are the expert on those programs since they set it up.
Right, but so basically it came down to a point where they were just basically paying the people who originally would just simply make these into master trusts and then issue security off them. They would just simply create the spread by purchasing directly from them?
Well, so just again, not everybody issued auction rate. Just to give, again, that was $80 billion out of, say, $300 billion. So I don't want you to think of the whole market as auction rate because it wasn't. They were primarily concerned about loan originations. The administration was concerned, as I understood it, about students having loans to go to school, you know, like your classmates that are having trouble. And so the programs were focused on new originations, making sure that student lenders had the capital they needed to make new loans and could make it in a relatively, you know, in a way that didn't cause them to lose money.
So the originators became agents of the government then, at that point? I mean, if I make a loan to you and then he comes and buys it for me because he's the government, then it's a pass-through system.
I wouldn't say it like that. Pass-through means something else in securitization, and agency also usually means something else. One thing is to give some incentive to do something. It's another thing to make someone your agent, right?
Well, they're effectively, though. I mean, obviously not in direct in a direct bonded sense, but okay, fine, a partner, not in like a general or limited partner. I'm not talking about the legal sense of things, but basically, if all I know is that I'm going to make an origination loan to you, and I'm going to be able to sell it off to the government almost immediately, then I'm just sort of working. You know, it's a very symbiotic relationship.
There's a competitive secondary market, so you're not just selling it just to one person. And the government creates incentives to do a lot of things. It would make us all agents of the government. Right? I mean, we get tax incentives to buy homes,
right,
to do what not. It doesn't make us an agent of the government. Right? So incentives don't make agents. And pass-through means something very specific in a securitization process. So I just had to clarify that,
because
this is not where we're at. But
You were on the verge of something? Dave has heard me say this before. I'm working on the book.
Oh, great.
And so my job is to connect the kinds of things we're talking about to the readers of the book,
okay,
who are asking themselves, why is my 401k half what it was?
Of course.
Why am I going to have to wait a number of years to retire? And imagine when you go on vacation with your husband, you meet some people, and somebody says, you work for the Fed. How'd this happen?
Yeah.
What is it you say? How can you connect what we've been doing with the person who is out there asking about the impact on their lives? Is that too vague a question?
Can you make it a little more focused in the student loan context?
Yeah, I know. The one thing you did talk about was when the student loan market tightens up, that clearly has an impact at the consumer level.
Yep.
I am wondering in what other ways, and maybe you said them and I, for some reason, didn't hear them, what other ways what you're talking about, what you do, plays out at the consumer level?
What I do in my role
here
as a student loan analyst?
Yes. Well, in your role, in analyzing the Fed and analyzing the activity here, what is it? How would you characterize the impact on the consumer? Sounds like a very. You're looking at me as if, why is he asking me this question?
I understand why you're asking. I'm a little stuck. Maybe you could break the question down a little more.
Well, is it this is obviously very relevant to people who sit and think about securitization and in markets, but how is it relevant to someone who's a consumer?
Oh, okay. I feel like this is going a little bit outside the parameters, but I'll answer to the extent I feel like I have a good answer, which is that a large share of consumer loans are funded through securitization, especially auto loans. It's easiest, I think, for me to talk about this in the auto loan context, because that's where it's clearest. Like, if you look in auto loans, for example, maybe about a third of auto loans are originated by finance companies. And when the securitization markets shut down, the finance companies had a very hard time offering loans to consumers. And so interest rates on auto loans went up quite a bit, and people either couldn't get auto loans, or if they did, it was at a very high rate of interest. And so the same thing in the student loan market, right? This fundamental breakdown in the securitization market, this fundamental breakdown in the short-term funding markets, which is basically what caused CP and LIBOR to diverge, made it no longer profitable for student lenders. And the difference between the student lender, the auto lender case, is that student lenders can't raise rates. Right, the terms of the loan are dictated to them by the government. So all a student lender can do is make the loan or not make the loan. Right, whereas in the auto lender market, they've got more parameters. You know, they can raise the interest rate or they can ask for a higher down payment. They don't just have this binary choice of make the loan or not make the loan. In the student loan sector, since the price is fixed, when their cost of funding went up, the only thing they could do is leave the market entirely. entirely and just not make the loan because there weren't any other parameters. And that's why, you know, at Stewart's Law School, they couldn't, students didn't know that they were going to get loans. And it is, you know, since every book has a hero, and since it's, you know, not my agency, I can say, you know, the Department of Education did some very, very creative things to make sure that students could get their loans. Like, they really did very, you know, like things that as a taxpayer you should be really proud of. They devised very sensible programs to let student loans keep being made.
The spread in LIBOR versus commercial paper, I guess, took you, like everybody else, by complete surprise.
Well, I didn't follow short-term funding markets, so yes, but I didn't follow them. So, I mean, it's just I do household finance at the Fed. I don't do, you know, money markets, CP markets.
How would you describe household finance? What does that mean at the Fed?
It means all loans to consumers, so mortgages, credit cards, auto loans, student loans, both at the consumer end and the institutions that supply the funds to consumers.
So the point is, this breakdown in the securitization market means it was harder to get these student loans. People might have to go elsewhere to get that money to send kids to school.
Yeah. And that's why, I mean, this is a totally different topic, but, you know, so that's why the Federal Reserve introduced the TALF program. It was the exact same worry, that consumers literally could not get loans, as in the student loan case, because of the securitization market breaking down. And people, you know, the Fed thought that wasn't good. They thought consumers and small businesses should be able to get loans.
But the LIBOR market could have gotten disrupted without the securitization getting disrupted, and that would have also caused a problem for the originations, right?
Leaving the LIBOR CP market?
Yeah.
Yes, I just think they weren't independent events. I think the problems in the
short
term.
Well, in this case, they
yes,
weren't.
Right. Right, but the
you could envision a situation where
right.
the LIBOR, the interbank market, would be disrupted by something other than problems in securitized
right.
mortgage products.
Right. Right. So that could have happened. It was a vulnerability, perhaps, in the program.
When you were working through some of these problems, were there any precedents you turned back to say, well, this happened then, maybe this will work? Or was it all brand new territory?
In the student loan, well, again, I mean, you know, most of the action was happening at the Department of Education and the Department of the Treasury. So those are really the places you should talk to because they put the programs together.
Thanks.
This is great.
Okay.
Karen, this has been very helpful.